I am so very honored to have Stephen Melillo with me. Stephen was actually nominated for a Pulitzer Prize for a work we're going to be talking about that was the most moving piece I've ever seen on a subject most people don't even want to talk about, which was the Bataan Death March, which he created a piece for with all of his heart and soul. Which started a long time ago and evolved to the point where it was redone April 21st with some amazing young band musicians that played on April 21st at a base there. This is a beautiful, deep piece, Stephen, and I have to take you back to what in the world started this process of you writing this powerful emotional tribute to these veterans.
Okay, so in 1998, they had a what was called a Bataan Death March reenactment in New Mexico. I read about it in Men's Health magazine and said, "Oh, that's interesting. I want to do this. I want to go on it and go on this 26-mile walk." So I went there, not expecting anything really, except that something happened that changed my life forever, and that was this. You see, when you learn about the Bataan Death March in high school, let's say in a history book, you might get a sentence or two, maybe a paragraph about this thing called the Bataan Death March. But when you see the word death, you make the assumption that there must have been this excruciating march that people were put on and they died.
I thought everyone had died on the death march.
I had no idea that I would meet survivors of the Bataan Death March. In fact, I was talking to a guy, his name is Jack Aldridge. I was talking to him for an hour before it finally dawned on me. And I said, "Wait a minute, you were there?" And he sat back in his chair with his cane, and he nodded his head like this. And it broke my heart because I knew by that point the suffering and the sacrifice that these guys had gone through. After that, Jack introduced me to his buddies, and I met like 10 of these guys who were Bataan Death March survivors, all from the 200th Coastal Artillery, who were stationed in the Philippines when the Japanese hit. So when the Japanese hit here on December 7th, that was their December 8th, and the attack was simultaneous. So they were actually the first ones to fire on the Japanese Empire in World War II in the Pacific. So after that, I was called back to New Mexico. "We want you to write a piece for our local Bataan Death March survivors." And so I sat at a table, and there was like 20 people from all different kinds of entities, like the Ford Foundation and so on, a lot of local people, so on. And they sat at this table and they said, "Here's what we want to do. We want to commission you to write a 6-minute piece for our local Bataan Death March survivors." And my jaw dropped. And I said, "Wait a minute. Are you trying to tell me that all you have to do to get a 6-minute band piece written for you, stuck on the middle of some other concert with a bunch of other pieces for band, all you got to do is be a prisoner of the Japanese for 3.5 years, suffer the hell ships, suffer the slave camps, work in the mines? That's all you got to do." And so they looked at me and I said, "Look, you've grossly underestimated what it is these men need." And notice how that's the first word, need. What they want, because they can't even speak it, it's coming from their heart. And what they deserve. You've grossly underestimated that. But I'll make a deal. I'll make a deal with you. You pay me for a 6-minute piece, And I'll write what I think those men need and what they want and what they deserve. And that was the deal.
And it came out to be how long? How big?
Just the Beyond Courage portion of it is about 55 minutes. When you add to it my arrangement of God Bless America, which the men asked me to do, this is key, and then my arrangement of the national anthem, when you add that together, it's about a 65-minute sojourn. It is a self-contained concert. Now, we mentioned this before, before we were actually recording this, so I want to let people know. Words like unbelievable or epic are hyperbolic, because a lot of times they use those words for pieces which are not epic and not unbelievable, okay? This work, we're going to measure it by what it accomplishes, not by what we think. And in 2007, this is actually 3 years after the premiere of the piece in Roswell, New Mexico, a guy came up to me. He was the son of one of the Death March survivors. He said, "Hey, can I get 17 copies of this?" And I said, "Absolutely." I had given out 350 copies of the Japanese military playing this piece. Japanese military.
Wow.
So I said, "Sure." I gave 17 copies to this
copies
guy.
He took it. Music or copies of, because I know
at this point I had visualized it. So in other words, I did the reverse of film scoring. I took the recording and I visualized it. I got over 40 hours of footage from all kinds of places. We can't get into that because it's so deep. I mean, I could do a year course on it.
Well, because you're a historian, I should mention that does play into this. Because you
and I had 170 minutes of audio copyrights that I purchased, and I'll explain why in just a second. So I created this DVD, and he wanted a copy of that DVD. 17 copies went to the Congress, and as a result of that, it's a piece of music. Remember, everybody, this is a piece of music. Let's not talk about the Grammys or Oscars, nothing like that. Let's talk about what it did for those men. It got guys who were on the Bataan Death March Bronze Stars and Purple Hearts 62 years after they had been forgotten. To me, that is a valuable role of music and elevates it to, it's okay to use the word unbelievable, and it's okay to use the word epic.
And Memorial Day is about that. And there was this beautiful, unbelievably touching thank you, because you went way beyond what you were commissioned to do. You went by what your heart and soul said you had to do. And when they saw this, it was life-changing for them, because you were able to express in music what you felt, which completely aligned with how you completely empathized with what they went through. And you were touched by a gift that they handed you. One of the survivors that was there handed you a medal that he received.
I had pulled this off the wall before, and this is the medal, that the pin of the regiment, the 200th Coastal Artillery from New Mexico. And Jack Aldridge at the premiere took the pin of the regiment off of his lapel and pasted it onto my, I can never tell this without tearing up, and pinned it onto my lapel and said, "From this day forward, you are my grandson." Now, I don't take it lightly. You know, I wanted to cook for him. I wanted to do everything I could for him. I wanted to let him know that not one second of his life was wasted, and that the tragedy and the agony and the suffering and everything else that he went through paid off.
That we might live.
That we might live. That's the whole thing, right? You did this that we might live. So I want to talk to you about what was the mission of this piece and how the mission was accomplished. When I started to write this piece, I knew what I wanted to accomplish, but I also knew that to accomplish it, it would be very dangerous, because I wanted to play the idea of, you know, how like a psychiatrist will use hypnosis and bring someone back in time. They will relive this thing that they had suffered through, right? And they'll get to the crux. They'll get to the moment where it could go either way. And then a skilled psychiatrist will show them the other way, and then they'll be healed. Well, that was my sort of crazy idea at the beginning. So I said, how am I going to achieve this? And I went out and I purchased the copyrights to 70 different pieces, over 170 minutes of music. As the composer was to organize all of this into a absolutely historically correct timeline, things that were playing on the radio, things that were being spoken, things that you hear from FDR, things that you hear from Winston Churchill, and put them in such a sequence of events that you are reliving exactly what you felt when you were called into the service to fight the Japanese Empire. That's all that happened. We lived through Pearl Harbor again. We lived through everything. And this is about 55 minutes of darkness, of suffering. Mm-hmm. And it takes us to when the Japanese haul up the white flag. Now, why was this so important? Every April 9th, and this is what I learned when I went out to New Mexico, they would have a celebration. Now, I'm using that word in an opposite way here. And they would raise a white flag on April 9th.
Mm.
Why are you raising a white flag to commemorate the day when we were surrendered to the Japanese Empire? And they always said, we did not surrender. We were surrendered. Our leaders surrendered us. We would have fought. We would have fought. They keep saying that. So in this piece, all takes us up to the white flag. White flag goes up. We experience all of the hurt, the tragedy, the 3.5 years of Auschwitz-like conditions, until that white flag comes down toward the end of the piece and a 46-star American flag is raised.
Wow.
It is spine-chilling moment. When the guys in New Mexico saw this premiere, I'm not kidding you, they came in hunched over, you know, walking on their canes. And when this piece was over, they were standing like this with their chests inflated. And I asked them to come up and stand, because when you think it's over, it's not over. I asked them to stand with me in front of the group, you know, a chorus and a wind ensemble. And I said, I got another something for you. And it's my arrangement of God Bless America. And it's like you've never heard it before. You know, it's you hear it. And it's all about home. It's all about coming home.
Mm.
Very, very powerful. It healed them. They stopped, you know, this idea of the white flag.
Mm-hmm.
They were finally remembered,
yeah,
by the Congress, and mission accomplished.
You know, you did such an amazing job with the historical pieces. And I wasn't aware when I watched it about how you brought in Winston Churchill and how you studied that as well. And coming round to the most recent events, you have a wonderful son named Schaefer, and he also plays beautifully. And you have made a point of playing taps, and having you or Schaefer, sometimes both of you, I didn't realize there was a way to do taps that echoed. You just told me this for the first time, but you have been doing this for veterans. And you did that just recently. And you realized something I think most people did not realize, which I think makes the sacrifice maybe more powerful, which was at the end of TAPS, you found out that Winston Churchill actually had revelry played, which some people would think, how could you do that? You know, like what, TAPS and revelry? Can you explain that?
Winston Churchill's faith was such that he believed in the resurrection, right? So you hear taps, but then he asked the second trumpet player to play reveille. The first time that I did that, I played both taps and then reveille. This was like really, my kids were too young yet. Was for Turk Turner. He was one of the Bataan guys. And he had that faith, and his wife had that faith. And I went up to his wife, and she, by the way, she's at the 21 April concert, Nell Turner. And I went up to Nell and I said, Nell, you know, of all the people that I know, Turk should have Turk reveille played as the echo to taps. And she was like, yes, yes. And so for the first time there it was, you know, you boom, 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 but then and it's like such a contrast, but it really is a summation of our faith that, you know, the soul is going on, soul is passing on. Just yesterday, Schaefer and I played for a World War II veteran, and he had passed away 3 years ago, and they were actually just interring his ashes at this service. But with all of his brothers and cousins, everybody who fought in World War II, they're all buried together in the same spot. And I asked the daughter, I said, do you think that it would be proper to play reveille rather than to play taps again in an echo? And she was like, oh yes, that's definitely what my father was all about. And I explained to her about Winston Churchill, and oh, my father loved Winston Churchill. I said, well, then we have to do this. So yesterday, that's what we did. We played taps and then reveille, and I watched all the people there with smiles on their face, you know, because you really have to confront your own faith. Of course, after 3 years, it's a little bit easier, right? You and say, do I really believe that life goes on? And for those people that do, yeah, reveille is definitely appropriate.
And you know, and I know, the music is so powerful that it's not only the emotions, but it carries its energy field, and it is waves of energy that goes on, just like what we're talking about, energy carried in radio waves or any kind of waves moves on. And yes, on some level, those energy waves, the music of the revelry is recognized on a higher way, in a higher plane, that this is the beginning, the wake up call from the aloha, the goodbye, to the call, you know, of the wake up on the next level. And it again makes the sacrifice seem to have more import and sense and acceptable, because sacrifice is not an acceptable thing for a lot of people. And I think that may be, Stephen, why a lot of people don't want to hear the depth of the sorrow and agony that these people faced. It's very hard for people when they're already going into overwhelm and difficult times to think of even more difficult times. Part of us wants to think that, you know, some of that didn't happen. This has been, I think, a problem with and for so many veterans when they returned home, is that there's many people that want to move on and, okay, that's over, you know, that's done. Why should we relive it? And I think,
you know, one of the greatest accomplishments from this last concert is this. So we had kids coming from Buffalo. They left at 4:30 a.m. Charter bus drivers quit on them, even though they had a contract, and they had to come down in school buses. So I want you to picture this: a band and a chorus leaving at 4:30 a.m., getting to a Navy base, having to go through the, you know, the military guards. Yeah. They're vetted to do this, right? They come through at 9:10 p.m. after that long day on school buses, and they come in and we start rehearsing. The other band from Belmore, New York, they did the same thing. They left early. They got there. They waited. They got there first. So they waited for these kids, like 2 hours. They waited on a Navy base, really no air conditioning, on a stage that's not conducive to do this kind of a concert at all. But it's there for our active military. It's there for our veterans. What was one of the most important things about this? It's not just what happened to the audience, because that's obvious, right? You have tears of joy and you have tears of appreciation. They get it. That's good. But when all of these kids, and I mean all of them, when these kids were coming up and after all of that that they had been through, expressing the fact that they understood why they did this, what it meant to be a patriot, what it meant to understand the sacrifice of others, the words that were coming from their mouths, these 14, 15, 16, 17-year-old kids, including my kids, they played, and they, you know, the band directors let my two kids play trumpet 3 and trumpet 1, and they both played taps in the piece. Just the meaning of what they had done had resonated with them so much that when they were going back, one of the bands, when they were going back to Long Island, if you can picture this now, high school kids, they, without prompting, broke into the national anthem and they started singing the national anthem together on that bus. The band director, you know, called me and said, listen to this, because that was their way of saying, we get it. And that's an important mission. You know, we have a lot of the guys who were in the audience came up to me and said, you know what? This whole thing that happened tonight is really about hope. I said, okay, what do you mean? What do you mean? He goes, because when I look at television and when I watch the news and I see all the stuff going on, I have a very dark vision about where this country is going. And then to see these kids get together and do this and give what they gave, I just have hope for the future. I go, you just keep having that hope, because this is the majority of people. It's not like you get on TV. There's a lot of people like this who understand the cost of freedom.
And it's so powerful that that energy and that, oh, that true understanding of what happened and the price paid, which can be forgotten, unfortunately, too easily, way too easily these days. We have so many distractions from that pain, you know, video games, whatever, you know, it's so many distractions. But it's only through, I think, understanding, as you did when you went back, almost like you traveled back to where they actually experienced that. Until you do that, are you really, I think, learning the lesson that we all need to learn to understand how you can finally see what people gave and maybe have a sense of the sacrifice. And with that sacrifice being hopefully, like the word hope again, that we have maybe learned some lesson. Now, you know what? You and I have talked about this, you know. It's a very hard lesson to learn. And I think sometimes this planet, we pray for peace all the time. And you know, and I know, my gosh, we're still seeing the cost of war. But at the same time, maybe there's a little bit of understanding what that all is for.
You have to understand history. If you don't understand history, you are going to repeat things. And in fact, even when I made my opening speech that night on the 21st, I implied that everything that you're going to see in this piece is in fact repeating itself now. Just as we had going into World War II, these set of variables, these set of conditions and parameters, those exact same things are happening now for those with eyes to see and those with ears to hear. You know, years ago when I was in high school, there used to be a t-shirt, right? And it said, just do it. I think it was a Nike shirt, right? Nike,
yeah.
Just do it. So I came up with a t-shirt, right? And I said, just do what your t-shirt says. See, the problem is that everybody has buzzwords. We talked about unbelievable and epic before. How about let's add simpatico and let's add compassion to that? What good are the words unless you actually live with compassion? So what does that mean? Compassion with passion. Yes. What is simpatico? It's to really feel. What is empathy? It's to really feel. Yeah. So if you use those words, and you use them as buzzwords, and you're not really living those things, then you're not living your t-shirt. And the trick is to live your t-shirt. If you're going to say something, you have to live it. And it takes, you know, sacrifice takes sacrifice. It sounds so simple, but that's the truth. You can't just, oh yeah, I'm going to write a piece about sacrifice. Oh, okay. Well, what have you sacrificed? How do you know the pain and the struggle? And unless you're a truly empathetic person, you know, I talked to a guy for 3 years. This is important, Cindy. I talked to a guy for 3 years, Charlie Dowdy. On the first day, he said to me, I don't know why you come here. He goes, you'll never understand what we went through. 3 years later, we were talking and he was laughing. I had him laugh. That was my big mission, you know, make these guys laugh. I'd call him up. I'd try to, because I believed that laughter would keep them around longer, right? So I'd call them up. I'd tell them jokes. I'd go cut their lawn. I'd, you know, I'd make a fool of myself. I'd do whatever I had to do. I wanted them to laugh. And 3 years after Charlie Dowdy said to me, you're never going to understand it. I don't even know why you're here. He was laughing because he saw that I was still there. You see, it took 3 years, but it took him 3 years to go, oh, well, this guy. And I said to him, Charlie, there's no way I'm ever going to understand what you went through. He goes, but I'm going to try. And if you keep talking to me, I'll keep listening. And he was actually the first guy I played taps for.
Wow.
He was the first one of the guys that I knew that left us.
I was talking to, I did a whole course about, and videotaped a course on, that was being done on death and dying by some of the top scholars, and they had teachings and people attended the courses. And there was this Japanese lady who, Japanese American lady who was taking the course. And during the course of the course, she contracted cancer and a death sentence. And she told the teacher, the professor, very respected teacher, she says, you know, Professor, I've been taking this course and I hope to find some help with this course, but now I know that I'm dying. Taking a course on dying and actually dying is a very different thing.
Hmm.
And I think it's the same as what we're talking about here, true empath, true compassion. True sacrifice can be talked about. In fact, we talked about it about a month ago. I did a talk on it. I did a class on this and about the sacrifice and what we can go through and how to solve that and get through it. And then through some things I'm going through, I'm going, boy, it's a lot harder when I'm starting to go through my things than what you might think you're told. And I think that's the truth of what our country and the history and the feeling of what the people you experienced and dedicated so much to, what it took to actually understand how living it and dying for it, how the feeling of it and that true feeling is. And I think you accomplished it. I think you accomplished it so powerfully and so beautifully that these teenagers who are able to perform it, their lives will be changed from that experience.
I think they felt what I felt, which is, it's impossible for me to listen to that music. It's impossible for me to conduct it, especially without crying at the end. And ironically, I don't cry at the tragic sections. I cry at the triumphal section. And the reason is, I'm going to cry even thinking about it now. The reason is because I honestly feel that those men, bear with me. I honestly feel that those men who would otherwise be forgotten are at that moment alive again. And they're saying, thank you for remembering us. Thank you that our life was not in vain.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I said to Jack, wouldn't it have been better if God picked John Williams to do this? Because then you'd have, you know, millions of people would know about it. Why in God's name, would God pick the littlest of the little drummer boys and give him this task? And Jack said, get ready for this, because you're one of us.
Wow.
You're one. Yeah, you get it?
Well, on that note, I don't know if we play taps at this point or rubbery, but on that note, I think we just have to let people experience some of this. I hope that people will take the time to be able to see. There was video done. There's more on your site that has been done. And that really will tell the rest of the story. People do have the time. Can you get people know the best way to find out more? Maybe to get that DVD, if people even play DVDs anymore, to get more information on this.
For the DVD, just go to my website, stormworld.com, and go to tracks. And it's all separated up. There's like 52 CDs. And then there's like a few DVDs on the very bottom. You got to scroll all the way down to the bottom. And you'll find That We Might Live. It's called Kakehashi, That We Might Live. The Japanese word Kakehashi means a bridge to the future.
Mm.
And so that's what this is really about. Because even the Japanese, remember now, the Japanese military played this. And it had to be approved through the Japanese Ministry of Defense. This was not approved by musicians. It was approved by the government of Japan. And they knew that they were extending an olive branch. Because, you see, it's really, war is really not about people versus people. It's governments and their stupidity versus governments. And people are the cannon fodder. And that's another thing that's brought about in this piece, that these great human beings were sacrificed. And of course, don't get me started. The history is too vast. You know, why does Winston Churchill appear in this piece? Because they wanted to fight Hitler. They didn't want to fight the Japanese, but they used the Japanese to attack Pearl Harbor as an excuse to get into World War II and Hitler first. That was the expression. Hitler first. Mm. Hitler first meant that our guys over there, Batan and Corregidor, were expendable.
Mm.
Think about that.
Yeah. No compassion, no empathy, no understanding. And that's what can happen. That's what is sometimes heartbreaking. And I know you did your best to try. And I know you did more than you probably ever could have expected you could do when you started this, to accomplish that feeling of understanding for this situation. I know you changed lives with this piece, and that's why I had to talk to you. I said, for Memorial Day, this story has to be told, because there's so much more. There's so much more than we might give some kind of pause to understand going on here, that we might live. So I always thank you. You do so much more than people realize. But I know all of those in the Bataan Death March were there and did want to thank you. And I know that the students that played on April 21st, lives understood, and their lives will be changed from that experience, that powerful experience that they went through. And I just hope that the ripples effect of what you've created, and I do believe it will go on and on, to help people to understand.
Cool.
Thank you, Stephen. Thank you, Stephen. God bless you.
God bless you too. Thanks a lot.